Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IEA London YouTube channel, but we've taken the audio and turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Hello again, friends. How are you doing? This is Chris Snowden. You're watching another episode of The Swift Half with Snowden. Hope you've been well these past couple of weeks since we last broadcast. I've got an excellent guest today. You know the drill. We're going to talk for half an hour about whatever takes our fancy. We're recording this on Wednesday the 20th. So I think cover some topical subject matter for you. He is Matt Lesh. Matt Lesh has moved from the world's second greatest think tank to the world's greatest think tank. He was at the Adam Smith Institute, and now he's at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Following in your great footsteps.
Yes, and many other people over the years, I guess. It's a bit of I wouldn't say a revolving door, but we go back and forth from time to time. Yeah.
The best was Kate, of course, who started at the IEA, went to the ASI, then went back to the IEA. Kate Andrews is now at The Spectator and has gone on to better undergraduate things than either of us combined.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think I'd rather work at the IEA than Spectator, but you know, each to their own. How have you been these last few weeks and months and indeed years?
Yeah,
I mean, years of the pandemic and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Paris over the weekend, and I just can't get over the sense of contrast where in the UK, more or less, half through government dictate, but more so through just the general instincts of people, we just don't really care that much about the pandemic anymore. In France, everywhere you go, you're getting COVID pass check. It's not that much of an inconvenience. You know, I don't think it's the end of human rights as we know it, but it's a nice contrast to UK where you come back, you know, almost nobody's wearing masks. The minute you get off the Eurostar, you can take off your mask and it's all okay. So it feels like life really, at least for me, is largely back to normal, with the exception that I'm now working from home, which I never did very much pre-pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the same. I was actually in Croatia last week. And to be fair, it's exactly the same as it is here, as far as I could tell. Certainly haven't got any vaccine passports. I didn't really see very many people at all wearing masks. See, I'm not sure what it's like across Europe. There's this kind of assumption from a lot of people who want to bring in lots of restrictions that the whole of Europe is still kind of semi-locked down. Everybody's wearing masks outdoors, vaccine passports everywhere. And I haven't looked into what each country does, but I'm pretty sure that it's not just Croatia, put it that way. Do you have any idea about what the kind of spread of regulations is like?
Yeah, it's ever changing. I was in Barcelona a few months ago, and they had this bizarre overnight curfew where you couldn't be outside from the hours of 1 p.m. to 6 a.m. because for some reason COVID, you stop spreading after 6 a.m. and start spreading again at 1 a.m. and there's some kind of arbitrary rules. But I mean, more or less, with the exception of COVID passes and a lot more mask wearing, I didn't feel like Paris was any different to London. Life was kind of going on as normal. I didn't go out clubbing or anything, but I think that's all open. And mass events are open. It does feel like most of the rest of the world is moving on. The UK slightly ahead. There was interesting reporting from the FT, kind of theorizing why the UK has more COVID cases at the moment. And you can probably separate out a few different things. One is the fact that the Brits have chosen to get back to normal. So the extent to which Brits are willing to go to mass events is much higher than elsewhere in Europe, and it's mass events that are the super spread events. And on top of that, masks probably make a marginal influence. I mean, I'm a kind of pro-mask, I'm not pro-mask mandate, but the Brits are wearing masks a bit less than everyone else. And on top of the fact that as a result of the UK getting ahead with vaccinations, you've ended up in a situation where the waning immunity is coming back to bite first in the UK in the way that it did in Israel. But unlike Israel, the UK was very slow to approve booster shots, and the NHS is not working at full speed ahead on booster shots. So you bring all those things together, and you've got these rising case numbers and these rising hospitalizations.
Yeah, I saw the same thread, I think. I was kind of surprised, actually, how many people, not just in the UK, but in even more so, in fact, in Europe, are still not doing a lot of these things. Like something like 70-80% still not going, or they, so they say, not going to mass gatherings. They're wearing face masks, you know, maybe not as much as ever, but you know, the proportion of people who are just never wearing a face mask is still really low. Not going to I don't think it was specifically pubs and clubs, but it was that kind of thing. You know, a significant majority of people still haven't moved on all that much, from what I could tell. I don't know whether to believe these surveys. I don't know if it was a YouGov one. You do get some particularly kind of, because it's online, and I think you kind of get paid and you subscribe to YouGov, but they always seem to have what, maybe I'm the one who's biased, but they seem to have people who are particularly reticent to kind of go out and live in the world, and particularly keen on lockdown restrictions. But maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think there's probably two ones. One element of it is there's a proportion of people who never go to mass events. So I don't know what the proportion is before COVID of people who don't really go to pubs that much, who don't really do these sort of things, who live, you know, not necessarily as vice-filled lives as ourselves, Chris. And then on top of that, there's probably some social signaling going on as well, which is people are answering the way in which they think they should answer, rather than the way they necessarily have acted in recent history. So a good technique to get around that is, what are your friends doing, rather than what are you doing? I haven't seen comparative polling on that, but if you say to someone, you know, what are your friends doing? Are they going out to pubs? You usually get a more accurate answer as to what the population is doing, rather than asking someone individually who feels like they need to say, you know, I'm still not going to mass gatherings.
Yeah, I think, actions speak louder than words, and, you know, you just don't see that many. You'll take the London Underground, right? It's about the only place in the country where you're legally obliged to wear a face mask. And the few times I've been on it recently, I would say less than half are wearing face masks. Is that about fair?
Yeah, I think it's going down from what I can see in recent weeks and months. When there was a formal government-led mandate on masks, as opposed to a TFL mandate on masks, was definitely higher. But it's that fascinating comparison. You see Labour MPs wearing masks in Parliament and Tory MPs not wearing masks. It's become a political signal rather than actually something necessarily, or a social signal. You know, all my friends do wear masks, all my friends don't wear masks. What kind of social circle am I in? I was speaking to someone who a student in Oxford last night. He said no one in his college wears masks, but he happens to study epidemiology. So when he walks into the public health school, everyone in the public health school is immediately putting on masks. So and I'm sure the kids outside of there aren't wearing masks, just like Labour MPs apparently don't actually wear masks around Parliament. They only wear masks when they're on camera and need to signal with their colleagues that they are mask wearers and that they are righteous people.
Yeah, it was notable at the Tory party conference that I was at, and so were you last week, that the very little mask wearing going on. But I was speaking to people who also went to the Labour Party conference, and they said, yeah, there was more mask wearing, but not that much. It wasn't like, you know, that picture I think you're referring to in the House of Commons the other day, where it's literally every single Labour MP, I think maybe bar one, was wearing a mask, and every single Tory MP was not wearing a mask. It's obviously become politicised and really kind of part of the culture war now, isn't it? I think that's kind of borrowed from America, where it was a much bigger thing.
Yeah, it certainly has. There was an interesting study I was just looking at yesterday from, I think it was Sri Lanka, where they'd actually done a proper kind of semi-randomized trial on different villages, and they gave masks and encouraged people to wear masks in some villages. In other villages, they didn't, and then they did a study to check, you know, seroprevalence to check people's blood to see whether or not they had COVID. And it seemed like masks actually probably reduced COVID by about 9%. So I have no doubt that masks reduce transmission to some extent. They have some effect. The extent to which, though, it's I remember last year when this was first happening, we were told by our favourite person in the world, Jenny Harris, who was the Deputy Chief Medical Officer for England, is now heading up the replacement of Public Health England. We were told by her that masks are dangerous. Not that they don't work, but that they actually could increase the transmission. And at the time, the normie thing, the expected thing to do amongst the progressive class was to say masks are awful and terrible. And I came at the time saying, well, actually, public health authorities are telling us either a noble lie or they're deluded, because obviously putting a barrier between your face when you've got a viral disease spreading and other people is going to reduce the spread to some extent. And I have no doubt that has a marginal impact. The claim, though, that it is absolutely everything and that masks are the end all and be all of, you know, COVID protection seems quite absurd. And at some point you have to decide, well, do I want to take an ongoing risk with my life by not wearing a mask and taking that slightly higher marginal risk because I just can't bother wearing a mask? I'm vaccinated. I've had COVID before. You know, leaving that up to people to decide, I think, is the way to do it. So I'm not pro mandate as much as I am acknowledging the truth that they probably do something, but they're not everything.
They do something. Yeah, I'm the same as you. I think they probably have some effect, probably not that massive. Do you think that was a noble lie, by the way? I always kind of assumed it was, because, you know, just the fact that medics wear them makes me, and have done for a very long time, makes me assume that the medical establishment kind of knows they work to some extent. So I just assumed it was, well, you know, the government knows that there's a massive global mass shortage. We need to preserve them for the medics. However, I've got friends who say, no, they genuinely believe they didn't work. They were just wrong. Yeah. You know?
I think it was a bit of both. There was an assumption from previous pandemics that are not COVID, that masks aren't that effective, that it's just a weird kind of East Asian thing to wear masks around, this is not a particularly wise intervention. Combine that on top of the claims about running out of masks. And I think it was kind of bad economics, the sense in which, well, we've got a limited supply of masks and therefore we should lie to people and say that masks don't work, rather than thinking about, well, if we encourage people to get masks, supply will respond to demand, and that's what's happened. You know, masks are as cheap as chips now. They're absurdly cheap and everyone can have one. You could have also recommended much earlier cloth masks that have a marginal impact. So it seemed like the noble lie was a particularly stupid noble lie. I have no doubt, though, that some of the public health establishment genuinely did believe masks did nothing and they weren't helpful, and they were just fundamentally wrong in their assumptions based upon other pandemics and wrong theories. And this is where groupthink also comes in, which is the consensus view amongst the public health establishment, masks don't work, and therefore that kind of shuffle down to medical professionals who would then also say masks don't work. It's just the way the system works is it's all very social normy. It's whatever the social norms are in that group of what is the right thing to believe. We saw that with lockdown itself. You know, the amount of everyone in the UK kind of health community, established commentator community in early March last year told us lockdowns, you know, are stupid, don't do anything, are unnecessary. And then suddenly that very quickly flipped. And now lockdowns are everything and we need more interventions. So it just feels like there's a lot of groupthink that goes on in that particular world, and probably all scientific worlds, really.
In public health, there certainly is, yeah.
Indeed, as you know.
Where do you think we're going with this now? So we just had the NHS Confederation, which I must confess, I don't think I'd ever heard of before, which is led, I gather, by Matthew Taylor. He used to be the CEO of the Royal Society of Arts, and he was a former Labour advisor. He's a moral maze panelist, clearly a man of many talents. So they're saying we need to have Plan B plus immediately because we're up to like 50,000 cases a day. Plan B plus seems to involve, again, it's masks again, primarily. It's like vaccine passports and masks. And my kind of view of it is, firstly, that I think they've shot their bolt a bit early. I think it was always inevitable the NHS was going to say something like this, because, as you know, the NHS is always in crisis in winter, and they've now got more of an excuse than ever to kind of blame the public for it. But also, I think, is it mainly performative now, right? Because, as you say, if masks reduce infections by 9%, that's better than nothing, but that's going to get cases down from like 50,000 a day to 45,000 a day. It's just barely worth really bothering with. Vaccine passports, I doubt, would really have much effect either. So, I mean, they're not calling for a lockdown. Yeah, if you really wanted to get the cases down, you would call for a lockdown. It's the only thing that's ever really worked other than, you know, the vaccine effect, I guess. What do you make of it? And do you think the government's going to change course on this at some point?
Yeah, this is this awkward discussion where the NHS Confederation, who represent the kind of representative body of NHS commissioning groups. So it turns out NHS commissioning groups have their own union who want to come out and demand things. I think your analysis is right there, that they're pulling the trigger a bit soon. It's not clear what they mean. It's never been clear what they mean by NHS being overwhelmed. But that's the central guiding post for the government with respect to COVID. It's always been, when if it looks like we're going to have a Lombardy type situation where there's people in trolleys outside hospital rooms, we don't want that footage to come out. That'll create the perception the NHS is overwhelmed. Now, I think practically the NHS was overwhelmed at many points. They just managed to practically not let people go to hospital, so that they'd leave people in their homes to die rather than treating more people in hospital. And if you speak to doctors who are on the front line, or I think it's an exaggerated phrase, frontline, but they were the ones, respiratory doctors, they will say they had to make morally questionable decisions throughout the peak, both peaks in the pandemic, with respect to who they gave treatment to and who they didn't, who got a ventilator, who didn't, who got certain machinery when resources limited. So we have to ask ourselves, what should we do now, and to what extent of deaths are we willing to accept in society? And right now that the numbers are quite high. We're talking something like 40, 50,000 deaths a year from COVID as just background numbers, as in addition to, you know, all the other deaths going on. And I think we have to acknowledge that's quite a lot, and we should be doing everything we can to get that down. Should we be doing mandatory interventions and vaccine passports? My instinct is no. it's not necessary, but I suspect it's probably on its way, partly just because the government won't want that perception of the NHS being overwhelmed. This is, though, in my view, again, it's a failure when it comes to actually thinking about vaccines. We had months here to ensure that every vulnerable person got a vaccine. There's still, we did a paper last month, I did with James Lawson, looking at the issue of just the fact that there's still somewhere between 1.5, 2 million people over the age of 50 who are unvaccinated, who are vulnerable, and then also these booster shots, just because we know that the vaccine effectiveness goes down over time, and the government's been extremely slow with those booster shots. So again, we're getting a situation where the government could have acted earlier in a less interventionist way in order to protect public health, and now they're walking into a bit of a trap here because they haven't done the smarter things sooner.
Why is the booster shot rollout why is it so slow? I mean, you've been very good at looking at a lot of this stuff, and particularly Public Health England last year, and looking about why they were so lethargic and slow. Our vaccine rollout back in December did start off slow, but to be fair, it really picked up nicely. Why can't they kind of pick up where they left off with that? Or is it partly that the people are just going, look, sod it, I've had my two shots, that's enough now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a little bit both. I think there's a lot of people who haven't been invited. So with these booster shots, it's not that you can go to a center and just get jabbed. You actually have to get invited, and the process of inviting people seems to have been much slower. I think it's just that the NHS struggles to walk and talk at the same time. It's now got kind of the usual, medical issues as we're entering into winter. You've got hospitalizations. When the vaccine rollout really sped up, the NHS was otherwise actually pretty quiet because we were in lockdown, the case numbers had gone down. So they were able to really focus on doing this one thing very well, but then they shut down all that infrastructure, or at least a large amount of that infrastructure, and they didn't build a sustainable way to do the booster jabs. What would have been smart would have been to very quickly use the same supply chain they use with boots for flu jabs, so that when everyone was getting their flu jabs, they could have also got their COVID booster jab at the same time. But that's not on offer. You have to do two separate appointments. You have to do two separate processes of it. So it seems like they didn't have the same infrastructure they built up last time. And on top of that, the fact that they're using a separate process to do the booster jabs to flu jabs, and probably not private sector involved anywhere near enough. And you've got a situation where combined with probably some less interest in getting these booster jabs. And again, we just started late. This was the other fact, is you had all this dilly-dallying around in August, September. It seemed pretty obvious to me at the start of August that we were going to need booster jabs in the UK. And while we were pretty quick on approval off the mark in December last year for vaccines, we were very slow in approving booster jabs, despite various mounting signs of evidence, just that the committee process took so long, it just wasn't sped up. So now we're at a point where it's difficult to get this all done very quickly as we're getting all these increasing case numbers going around.
When, if ever, is this going to end then? Because I mean, it's really quite disappointing that these vaccines wane after like 4 or 5 months. I mean, are we just going to be constantly injecting old people at least for years to come?
In the sense, we don't know. These vaccines actually might end up being three dose regimens. So there are other vaccines that you get three times and then they give you shock enough protection. We didn't actually have long enough in the initial trials to see this kind of waning of immunity. So we didn't really know in advance whether or not, we thought it might be one shot, ended up being two shot. It might actually just be three shots and that'll be enough and it'll be sustainable. The general good news is even after two, or especially after three shots, you do have general what's called high T cell response, which means your body can create the antibodies which then fight the virus, which means even though if you can get the virus, you can fight it off pretty easily. In the medium to long term, what I think will be on the horizon are better vaccines, both updated vaccines for new variants, which we haven't actually done yet, which I think is crazy. We haven't updated the mRNA vaccine. We're still making the vaccine for the original COVID variant, not even the Alpha variant, not the Delta variant. So it's actually a little bit less effective as a result. We could update them. And on top of that, newer vaccine technologies that are being developed, the pan-coronavirus vaccine. So currently all the vaccines attack the spike protein on the outside of the coronavirus, super effective, but there's risk, of course, the spike protein changes over time, it evolves, and that's when you're going to need other vaccines that might be able to attack the center of the coronavirus and therefore be more effective across all different variants, and might even be so effective that there's other talk about nasal spray vaccines that could stop you from getting COVID altogether, could be 100% effective at preventing cases. So it's about the new technologies when it comes to COVID. Now, we actually called on the government to start on the process of procuring these new vaccines. The response, though, to a recent parliamentary question that was put in on this by Steve Baker was the government actually hasn't bought any next generation vaccines yet. So there are a bunch of different vaccines that we should probably be looking at purchasing. Like Kate Bingham did a great job last year purchasing the first generation of vaccines. But again, it's kind of gone back to a more traditional bureaucratic process when it comes to procurement. So they're not making the decisions they need to make at the speed at which they need to make them to stop the risk of COVID cases coming back and stop the demands for restrictions.
So yeah, interesting that history keeps repeating itself, and it's the same lessons every time, really, isn't it? Lack of private sector involvement, lack of foresight.
Yeah, and just slow process. There's something about just the public health establishment that they are acting like this is a long-term problem, you know, something like obesity or smoking, where you can, you know, spend a lot of time considering things. I think you'd probably argue they often lead to the wrong results when they do that, but they have a long period of time, you know, it's not an immediate issue, versus what they're doing now is more like a campaign. It's like a war. You know, you need to be on top of it every moment of every day. And we go through these periods of enhanced focus and pushing to make decisions. And then we go through other periods over the last 18 months where we just think it's all disappeared and then it comes back. And no surprise, it is going to come back over winter. I'm hoping it doesn't get anywhere near the point where it requires a lockdown. And I don't think it will, just because the vaccines are effective enough. But there will be this pressure on the NHS and there will be these demands for more restrictions, just because the NHS is such a central political topic.
Yeah, and you're obviously Australian. Tell us what it's like to live in a country that has a health service that provides good care all year round. Doesn't have a winter crisis every single year.
Yeah, I mean,
amazing.
I don't want to you know, talk up the Australian healthcare system too much. There are you know, winter pressures on the Australian healthcare system, but it's not something you'd ever hear talked about or spoken about. And it's not, the Australian healthcare system is very good. The outcomes are much better. Australia spends, I don't know, a couple points extra on GDP on healthcare, or, you know, than the UK. So it's not a huge difference. But what's key, and your colleague, Christian Niemitz did a good report on this recently, is Australia has kind of a mixed public.
Your colleague
system.
Too, now, mate.
My colleague too. Well, soon to be. Christian Niemitz did an excellent report kind of comparing the systems. And Australia has a very strong kind of almost NHS-like public system, but also at the same time has a parallel private system. So, and there's strong kind of tax incentives and strong subsidies to get people to buy private health insurance. That puts less pressure onto the public system. So there's a series of public hospitals, a series of private hospitals. Both of them are very high quality. A lot of the doctors and surgeons, whatever else, work across both the public and private systems, providing excellent quality care at a pretty comparative level. And there's a lot more, you know, investment and money floating around the system, just because you have all that private sector involvement in it. But what's key is that it's just a lot more patient-centric. So a key difference in Australia is that when you go see a doctor, so you've got effectively a choice. So you could go see a doctor that's called bulk bill. It's 100% state funded. It's funded by Medicare, which is like the national insurance system. And you go to a doctor, they get paid per patient visit. So they actually want to see you and they're happy to see you in person if needs be. Pandemic aside, but the incentive is for them to see you and spend time with you. You can pay a little bit extra and get a sooner appointment at a, you know, more convenient, fancier GP. So you do what is a co-payment, you know, £20 or whatever to go see a GP. So it's not quite the cost of seeing a GP in this country, which can be hundreds of pounds. You pay $20, $30 extra, partly subsidized by the government, partly out of your own pocket. And that seems to work quite well. And you can see doctors and there's very little complaints about access to GP appointments, and that kind of feeds through the whole system. It's built in such a way that its co-payments exist in a bunch of different places. You can make a contribution if you have the wealth, and you're encouraged to make a contribution if you have high wealth. That reduces pressure on the public system, and the delivery of it is a lot more decentralized as well, I'll add. So the federal government funds it, but the state governments operate the public hospitals. And even then, in most states, the public hospitals are basically locally run by local boards of high and mighty people in healthcare in the area. So it seems to function much better than the NHS. And this is where the discussion I have every single time you run into an Australian in London is, what is up with this obsession with the NHS? We cannot understand it whatsoever. And these are non-political people. They just don't get it, because they know the quality of healthcare they get in Australia is better and less stressful and less bureaucratic. And yet everyone is obsessed with the NHS here.
Apart from anything else, it'd be nice to live in a country where you could get through a general election without hearing about the healthcare system, right? I mean, it's not a normal thing for it to be the central focus of every single general election, invariably leading to the thing getting even more money. Just to have it depoliticized would be beautiful.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's fully depoliticized. It does come up in elections.
You've still got the Medicare and stuff, sure.
You've still got Medicare, which is a state-funded system. Interestingly enough, actually, the Labour Party in Australia ran an NHS privatisation style campaign at an election a few years ago. They didn't actually win the election, though, mind you. I think it was in 2017 or 2015. They were giving out these little, you get in Australia, everyone has like a Medicare card, and they're giving out these cards, you know, saying it's going to be privatised, they're going to privatise Medicare. It turns out their definition of privatisation was one IT contract that was being outsourced. That was it. That was the extent of privatisation. And they blew it up into this massive issue. It was called MediScare. It didn't end up working. It had some effect, no doubt, but it didn't end up working in order to get the vote. So you're right, it's not an issue, but it's not as central an issue to Australian politics, and it's not talked about every week of every day like it is over here.
No, it sounds blissful. Let's finish up by talking about one of the things that's annoyed me this week, which is after the sad death of David Amos, somehow the conversation has turned to social media and online anonymity. Can you tell me what the connection is between these two things?
I honestly wish I could. It seems so obviously clear that online anonymity had absolutely nothing to do, at least by all indications, had absolutely nothing to do with the tragic murder of Sir David Amos. By all reports, that the person who killed him was an Islamist terrorist, and not someone who was motivated by seeing anonymous posts. In fact, it said that he followed a named preacher, somebody who was happy to put their opinions to their name rather than someone who was anonymous online. What's happened here is that there's the kind of central moral panic about the internet, which is to say basically every societal issue at the moment is being blamed on tech companies, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Jack Dorsey, on Mark Zuckerberg, to become the favorite boogeyman. And on top of that, the fact that a lot of MPs some are genuinely abused and harassed on social media, and people say mean and terrible things to each other on social media, have no doubt about it. And they're keen to therefore pigeonhole that into the murder. There's no evidence whatsoever that abuse on social media has any links to actual abuse in the real world of MPs. People say mean things online, doesn't mean necessarily can act on them. It doesn't necessarily mean you can fix the problem. This whole idea about anonymity itself, though, is actually, I think, quite frightening and quite scary. And the whole concept of David's Law, which is to say the Online Safety Bill, which is already a momentously, disastrously awful piece of legislation that's going to have serious free speech implications. They then want to add another thing to that that's not currently in it, because the officials realize even it's not a good idea to end online anonymity. They don't even want to do it. No matter how much they want to censor the internet, they realize there's a lot of value about anonymity. Talking about a gay kid who's not out yet. I'm talking about a woman who's hiding away from an abusive partner. I'm talking about someone who is a whistleblower or someone who's a dissident from a authoritarian country. There's so many reasons to be anonymous. There's even, as Sam Bowman pointed out in quite an excellent list of reasons, just people who have a professional life who can't connect to their online opinions. You might want to say something about COVID. You might be able to make an interesting contribution, but can't put it to their own name or make a contribution about politics. There's just so many reasons why you don't want to ban online anonymity. And on top of that, all the privacy implications of the fact that you'd have social media companies constantly gathering all our passports and driver's license in order to enact this in practice. It just goes on and on. It's an insane idea, but one that seems to have seeped in this week.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point just about the practicalities of it. I mean, you've got to prove who you are to these companies somehow. And that does seem a step too far. You've got to start giving your driving license and passports and all the rest of it. Because I guess the kind of, to play devil's advocate, most of these people are not saying that there should be no anonymity at all. It's just that you have to prove privately, if you like, with Twitter or Facebook who you are before you're allowed to be anonymous. But that still seems pretty risky thing to be doing to me.
Well, the government's already actually talking about in the Online Safety Bill is age verification. So this was originally going to be about porn sites, but now is more broadly in order to access any quote-unquote adult-facing content, so any content that's not appropriate for children. So any kind of, you know, violent content or any, you know, strong political debate or any aggressive content, whatever else it may be. The idea is that in order to access the full version of websites, you'd have to enter your driver's license, credit card, et cetera, and verify your age. That, again, raises that huge privacy concern of just all this massive data gathering. And there's always a risk as well. If you're a whistleblower, there's always a risk that somebody, you know, hacks the database that contains this information and links it to your account, and you lose your anonymity. And that risk is quite censorious in nature. There's a reason why people post things anonymously. I always find this great irony that the politicians, that ministers are saying that we need to end anonymity. They're the ones who literally every day are briefing journalists anonymously, who are making, clearly see some value in putting, not attributing things to your name because you can make a different kind of a comment. And yet if it's you and I who want to be anonymous, we're not allowed to do it.
That is a very good point. And we have to end it there. Matt, I agree with you about everything. Welcome aboard. Hope to see you in the office pretty soon when you start off with us. Thank you very much at home for watching another episode of The Swift Harvestone. We shall return as ever in a fortnight's time with somebody else interesting to chat to. If you want to give us some money, please do. Why not go to theia.org.uk/donate. You can become a patron or a patron, or whatever these people are called, but it's on patreon.com/IEA, I think. Who funds the IEA? Well, I'll tell you. Donald Blaney, Eric Keane, James Burns, Mark Edwards, Philip Ozouf, Richard Leader, Robert Appleby, Timothy Worrell, and Costa Manis. Thank you all very much. They're our premium Patreon subscribers. They help make it possible to put together digital content like this and much more. Next week we'll be live with Maplewood on a Wednesday, possibly a Thursday, 6 o'clock, in one of those 2 days. Tune in for that, live in the studio in Lord North Street. Anyway, for another 2 weeks, take care. Hope you don't get locked down in the meantime, and goodbye.